This is a Cato Special Podcast. I'm Caleb Brown. If it weren't for that one thing, the federal charges of illegally retaining classified documents, criminal conspiracy, and false statements now pending against former President Donald Trump would likely be both straightforward and pretty compelling to a jury. That one thing, of course, is that Trump is a former president who is currently running for president again. I spoke with Cato's Clark Neely about the indictment and how this case might shake out.
Yeah, so the federal indictment of Donald Trump that came down last week contains 37 counts. Most of those have to do with withholding or possessing and not turning over classified documents that Donald Trump is no longer permitted to possess because, of course, he's not the president anymore. He's just an ordinary citizen. As most people know, I think he took boxes and boxes of documents and mementos and other things with him when he left the Oval Office after President Biden was inaugurated. Almost all of that he wasn't supposed to take because it doesn't belong to him. Among those documents are some highly classified, including top secret documents that he has in his possession, even though he's not lawfully entitled to possess them. So those charges are brought under the Espionage Act and prohibit ordinary people from possessing national defense information, which is the technical term. The remaining charges involve false statements that were made or allegedly made to FBI agents and others regarding his response to a subpoena from a grand jury that ordered him to turn over documents with classification markings. And also, there is an alleged conspiracy to obstruct justice arising from his alleged effort to involve some of his lawyers and other staff members in a scheme to hide those documents and boxes of documents that he wanted to not turn over while turning over a smaller subset in response to the grand jury subpoena and representing falsely that an entire and complete production had been made, even though he knew that it had not. And how did he know it hadn't? Because he instructed his staff to withhold some of the documents.
That's the part here that's a little bit galling to me, if it bears out, is the notion that the government said, you have some things you're not entitled to, please give those back. And it appears as if, based again on just what the government is saying, that Donald Trump did everything he could to delay and then hand over a smaller subset, as you said, of documents that the government is entitled to. And it seemed as if there was very little attempt to hand back this material to which he is not entitled.
Absolutely. And I would just qualify that summary, which is otherwise I totally agree with, in two ways. The first is that the government did not say please. They said please initially. Over a course of a year, he was working with the National Archives and they wanted to get documents back. That was the please phase of this episode. But when the grand jury issued a subpoena, that wasn't please. That was you are ordered, just like any other citizen. And keep in mind, you're a former president. You're just like the rest of us. You're a citizen like the rest of us, and you can be ordered by a grand jury to produce documents. And if you disagree for some reason, maybe you think some of those documents are privileged or whatever, there's a procedure for asserting that. He didn't avail himself of that procedure. He just simply, again, as alleged in the indictment, came up with a scheme to withhold documents that he didn't wish to turn over despite having been ordered to do so through a lawfully issued grand jury subpoena. And then the other thing I guess I would qualify is that it wasn't just that he, you know, sort of failed to turn over some of these documents. He went out of his way to withhold them. This was, as alleged in the indictment, a knowing and deliberate effort, not only to withhold the documents, but to try to fool the government into believing that he had made a complete production under the grand jury subpoena. It's about as cynical and dishonest and law-flouting behavior as you can imagine. And as I said on a Twitter thread earlier, no self-respecting prosecutor's office in the country could fail to bring charges once they believe that someone has gone to such lengths to try to obstruct a legal process. So this indictment is totally unsurprising. And the one thing I guess I would add was, look, I've been a litigator for almost 20 years. I have read and or written hundreds of complaints. Sometimes you can tell that a complaint is written by somebody who thinks they know what happened, but they're not entirely sure, and they may or may not be able to prove it. Other times you read a complaint or an indictment and you can tell from the face of it, not only do they know exactly what happened, but they are absolutely going to be able to prove every single key element or allegation. And this indictment is the latter. it's very clear from this indictment that they are going to be able to prove every single important factual allegation through a combination of audio recordings that Trump himself made, video recordings from the property at Mar-a-Lago where the documents were both stored and hidden, and then also from the testimony of multiple witnesses that Trump is alleged to have, and consistent with his character, almost certainly did, try to involve in a conspiracy to refuse to produce the relevant documents and also hide them. And then the cherry on top, of course, is that all of this is entirely consistent with Donald Trump's personality as we've come to know it over the past 7 or 8 years that he's been in the political life. So if it weren't for one thing, I think his goose would be cooked.
Before we get to the one thing, the quality of the evidence, which you've mentioned here, seems to be very high.
Oh, I think so. I mean, again, an audio or video recording beats a serial liar almost every time. And so some of this evidence is going to come right out of his own mouth. Probably the most bombshell allegation in the indictment is where Trump is speaking with apparently a ghostwriter for a book for one of his cabinet officials, and a producer and some of his own staff members, not White House staff, but just personal staff because he's no longer president. And there's this colloquy where he apparently shows an extraordinarily sensitive document involving a battle plan for invading, we think, Iran, and, you know, has a bunch of self-serving statements to make about it, and then says, well, you know, this is still classified, and if I were still president, I could have declassified it, but I didn't. So, you know, I don't know if maybe there's a problem. And then his aide kind of says, oh, we'll have to sort that out later. So this completely guts his argument or his assertion that he's made in public that he just sort of declassified or automatically declassified all of the documents, including highly confidential top secret documents that are now in his possession or that were in his possession until the FBI came and got them. And this just flatly contradicts that out of his own mouth. He knew that he no longer had the power to declassify documents, and he knew that he had not declassified all the documents. So that's an extraordinarily powerful piece of evidence. And I think it's very difficult. It's going to be very difficult for him to run away from it. And there's plenty of other evidence that is going to be nearly as powerful as that. So again, I think except for one thing, he'd be toast.
Related to that, is there anything to read into the fact that there are 37 counts, or, you know, when, you know, people talk about charge stacking, but it doesn't really seem like that here, just based on the volume and quality of evidence that the government has.
Right. No, I mean, 31 of those counts just relate to individual documents that he allegedly had in his possession that he shouldn't have. I'm not familiar enough with the procedure to know whether they could have just brought all of those documents under one count, but they charged the retention of each individual document that he shouldn't have had in his possession as a separate count. But the real meat, I think, of the indictment is count 32, which is the conspiracy to obstruct justice, and also counts 34 and through 37, which involve more conspiracy allegations and corruptly concealing records and making false statements. And the reason I think those are such bombshell allegations are threefold. First, they're very simple crimes about which there is no dispute. There could be some dispute. Some people think that there's some dispute about whether the Presidential Records Act did or did not permit Trump to possess at least some of these documents. I frankly don't think those arguments are very substantial, but there is no argument that maybe he had some right to engage in a conspiracy to obstruct justice. That's going to be a very straightforward crime to prove. There's no argument that perhaps maybe it was okay for him to do it. And it carries potentially even more severe sentence than the document withholding claims. It's up to 20 years. The Espionage Act counts are 10 years apiece, but the obstruction, the conspiracy to commit obstruction is up to 20 years. Now, he's not looking at actually 20 years, but any ordinary person, you or I, would almost certainly be looking at something on the order of 5 to 10 years if we had done something so egregious.
You're alluding to it, the one thing, which is this is a former president, and this is a president that you appear to believe will get 3, 4, 5, all of the benefits of the doubt when it comes time to actually undertake this prosecution?
I suppose it's either one thing or two or three, depending how you break it out, but let's just make it simple. This is an extremely famous, brash, and norm-busting former president who is being prosecuted not only in the Southern District of Florida, which is a squirrely place, according to, you know, essentially anybody who practices criminal law down there, but in his own backyard, because the prosecutors in this case checked a box on the indictment that says they want this case to be brought not just in the Southern District of Florida, where they filed the indictment, but in West Palm Beach, which is a division. So districts, federal districts are broken into divisions, and they picked the division where he lives. And there are only three judges in that division, and one of them he appointed recently. Her name is Eileen Cannon, and she was involved in the case at an earlier stage involving litigation over the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago, and she did not distinguish herself. On the contrary, she was roundly criticized for some very strange rulings and rationales that she had made at that stage of the case. She was unanimously and swiftly, and might even say sharply, reversed by the 11th Circuit, and that is the judge they drew. So this judge, Eileen Cannon, who Donald Trump appointed, and who, by the way, has the power under Rule 29 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure to grant an acquittal in this case, an unappealable, unreviewable acquittal in this case, will be presiding unless for some reason she's removed.
Related to all that, in the criminal justice system, we tend to like the idea that there are many off-ramps from being engaged in the criminal justice system. The grand jury can choose not to indict. A judge can dismiss a case before trial. You can go to trial and you can be acquitted. You can be acquitted on appeal. But in this case, it seems the case is very strong, and yet he retains all of these things that you or I should receive in a criminal justice proceeding. Do you have any particular expectations?
I don't. I think that anybody who thought they could predict how this case is going to unfold is a fool. We've never seen anything like it. No president, no former president or sitting president has ever been charged with a crime, let alone indicted and prosecuted. So, and especially, I mean, look, there's so many factors in this case that would that essentially make it too complicated, I think, to predict. It's in Southern Florida, where Donald Trump lives. He's running for president. It's not just that he's a former president, he's running for president. And so the country is as polarized probably as it's ever been, or at least since either the Civil War or 1968 when I was born. I don't know, take your pick. So nobody can predict. And the other thing that's there's a real wild card here, in my view, and that is, why would such experienced, and I think smart, federal prosecutors choose to bring this case not only in Donald Trump's backyard where he lives in West Palm Beach, but in a division where there are only three possible choices of judges? There are only three judges in that division. One of them was going to preside over the case. And as they knew, one of them was this judge, Eileen Cannon, who'd already been involved in an earlier stage of the proceedings. And you know, look, I don't know her. And I would never say that just because a given president appointed a given judge, that means that judge can't be impartial with respect to that president. But I think it's suboptimal. It's suboptimal from the standpoint of optics. The track record so far is not encouraging. And again, judges possess this unilateral power once a jury has been impaneled to grant an acquittal that cannot be appealed or reviewed. You're right. That may be frustrating in this case. It's certainly frustrating to me. I think Donald Trump is a crook. I think he's been a crook for a long time. And I feel like the chickens have finally come home to roost. And it would be best for the country if he were convicted, just like any of us would be if we had done the things that are alleged in the indictment. But I am far from confident that that will happen. Now, look, that's the cost of having a system that has fail-safe mechanisms built into it. There is no perfect system. There are only trade-offs, as our friends in economics will tell us. And it may be that what's going to happen in this case is that we'll, in effect, those of us who would like to see Donald Trump convicted may end up paying the price for all those safeguards that are built into our system, and he may escape justice. But if he does escape justice, we have the comfort of knowing that he did so within the context of a system that is optimized to prefer false acquittals to false convictions. And I think that is a correct policy decision that the framers of the Constitution made, even if it has cost.
There is one other possibility. Maybe we go through this prosecution. Maybe we don't. It is possible for Joe Biden, this is a federal case, it is possible for the president to issue a pardon.
That's right. There are two possibilities that are difficult to contemplate because I think they are unlikely, but they are within the realm of possibility. The first is a presidential pardon from Joe Biden, who might feel that the country is best spared the embarrassment and turmoil of seeing a former president prosecuted in federal court. Now, there may be also a self-serving angle to that. It's been widely reported that Joe Biden and the Democrats would prefer to run against Donald Trump because they think that's the one likely Republican nominee that they can beat. The other possibility, and I think in some ways this is even more remote, is that the prosecution team may think that they can induce Donald Trump to waive his right to a trial and plead guilty, as most defendants in our system do. I've written about why I think that's unlikely for a variety of reasons. I think it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to induce Trump to plead guilty to any of these crimes. But prosecutors have an extraordinarily coercive and powerful toolbox of levers that they can apply and do routinely apply to defendants to induce them to plead guilty, which is why 98.3% of all federal criminal convictions last year came from guilty pleas. And it is possible that they have something up their sleeve that is so coercive and so powerful that they are confident that they can get Donald Trump to plead guilty, as most other defendants in his position would. I doubt it, but stay tuned.
Clark Neely is a Senior Vice President for Legal Studies at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.